Within a short time, he had gained military support from Hitler and Mussolini, while Stalin provided military backing for the Republican forces. The dictators on opposite sides of the Spanish Civil War were flexing their muscles. The Western democracies would once more come to reveal their weakness. The involvement of the major powers in the Civil War was the clearest sign, beyond the national tragedy for Spain's people, that Europe's international order was collapsing. The danger of the continent becoming engulfed in a new conflagration was growing ever stronger. Chapter 7. Towards the Abyss. Adolf Hitler, addressing military commanders: "The principle must not prevail that one can accommodate oneself to the circumstances and thus shirk the solution of the problems. The circumstances must rather be adapted to suit the demands. This is not possible without breaking in to other countries or attacking other people's possessions." War again. Only a generation after millions had bled to death on the killing fields of the great conflict of 1914-18 was a fearsome prospect to most Europeans. Yet few contemporaries were blind during the later 1930s to the gathering inexorable momentum towards another war. This time, there would be no question of slithering over the edge or sleepwalking by political and military leaders into a catastrophe that they only dimly foresaw. This time, there was an obvious aggressive power whose actions increasingly closed off all options other than war, or acceptance of domination of the European continent by the tyrannical might of Nazi Germany. The road to hell, as the saying goes, is paved with good intentions. That's the best gloss that can be placed on the way the Western democracies tried to deal with Hitler. Their flawed attempts to accommodate the German expansionist drive allowed Hitler to dictate events to which they could only weakly react. His blackmailers' response to their concessions was to ask for more. The rest of Europe looked on with ever greater anxiety. Everywhere, preparations were being made for a war that was greatly feared, but increasingly expected. The defeat of the left. The defeat of the left in Germany during the Depression years and its destruction in 1933 after Hitler's takeover of power now came into full perspective. Both German parties of the left, the Social Democratic Party and the Communist Party, had, if from different ideological positions, utterly opposed the militarism of the right that they rightly foresaw would lead ultimately to war. Had the left not been destroyed after Hitler's takeover of power, and had democracy, the mainstay of which had been the Social Democratic Party, survived in Germany, the odds on a new European war would have dropped sharply. Instead, the way was open for an assertive foreign policy favoured by the national conservative power elites, backed by shrill populist nationalism and subject to the increasingly high-risk gambles of Hitler. The left's tragic demise in Germany was only part of its wider defeat in most of Europe. Outside the Soviet Union, the left was almost everywhere powerless by 1935. Social democracy had held on to a stake in government in the Scandinavian countries, though these carried little weight in shaping the international constellation of power. Elsewhere, the forces of the right, invariably backed by the military, the police and the surveillance services, proved far too strong. Most of Europe, by the mid-1930s, was under some form of repressive nationalist regime, whether reactionary or outrightly fascist, leaving the left impotent and in the grip of the forces of fierce persecution. In the most powerful Western democracies, Great Britain and France, conservative-driven government had dominated in the Depression years. Here too, therefore, the left's political influence had been greatly diminished. The defeat of the left took place on a continental scale, even if national structures had conditioned its specific nature. It was partly a reflection of crippling divisions, the decisive one between its social democratic and its communist wings, though unity on the left didn't prevent its defeat in Austria. The communist left was itself disunited, sometimes broken into rival factions, and its major representation completely dominated by the interests of the Soviet Union. The defeat of the left also reflected the visceral detestation of socialist ideology and intense fear of communism in the upper and middle classes, the peasantry, and parts of the working class itself. Whereas nationalists of whatever variety held out an appeal to all sections of society, the left, whether socialist or communist, looked in the first instance to advancing the interests of a specific social group, the industrial working class. But the class politics of socialism, let alone the communist aim of a dictatorship of the proletariat, had self-evidently limited appeal to all those, the majority of the population, who saw themselves as certain losers should the left triumph. The fear of the left, particularly of Bolshevism, was hugely out of proportion to the left's actual power, or even potential for power, in most of Europe. But it's scarcely surprising, given the slogans of class hatred mouthed by the extreme left in the parts of Europe where it still had a voice, the horror stories seeping out of the Soviet Union and the dominance almost everywhere of a right-wing anti-socialist press, that so many Europeans were prepared to place their trust in those they imagined would maintain order and uphold national interests and not the interests of one specific class. False dawn in France. Amid all the deepening gloom for the left in Europe, one particular election offered a flicker of light. The French general election of 1936 produced a result that seemed an outright triumph for anti-fascism, a reversal at last of what had for years been a European-wide trend towards the militant extreme right. When the ballots of the second round of voting were counted on the 3rd of May 1936, the first round had been a week earlier, on the 26th of April, the Popular Front of Socialists, Communists and Radicals had won an astonishing victory with 376 seats, far exceeding the 222 of the Right's National Front. The euphoria among supporters of the left, workers but also most intellectuals, writers and artists, was immense. Manes Sperber was a Jewish writer born in 1905 in Poland, but exiled in Paris since his brief experience of German imprisonment in 1933, and an increasingly critical member of the Communist Party, which he would quit in 1937. He later wrote of his elation at the election result. For him, and for many others, he recalled, it was more than an election victory. It was as if a fresh wind had dispelled an oppressive, stifling air. A goal long seen as unreachable had come within grasp. Never had fraternity seemed so close as in the May days of 1936, he wrote. From all avenues, men, women and children poured into the squares of the Bastille and the Nation, their songs and cries of joy reaching adjoining streets, calling everyone to unite in the quest for justice and freedom, and all made possible without revolutionary violence. Sperber's humanitarian hopes soon revealed themselves to be a wildly optimistic dream. France remained a completely divided country. The hatred of the nationalist right for the Popular Front went far beyond conventional political opposition. Special vitriol was directed at its leader, Léon Blum, a Jewish intellectual who had been an early supporter of Dreyfus. Bloom had been physically assaulted by a nationalist mob in February 1936. And the previous spring, the leader of the far-right, Action Française, Charles Maurras, had appallingly denounced Bloom as a man to be shot in the back. The left's electoral triumph didn't lessen France's ideological polarization. In reality, the victory had been far less sweeping than it seemed at first sight. The left's proportion of the votes, 37.3%, was only marginally higher than the 35.9% won by the right. The major shift had been within the left itself, though this only increased the antagonism of the right. The radicals, the centrist mainstay of the Republic, had lost ground, down from 157 seats in 1932 to only 106 seats in 1936. The Socialists, the largest party in the Popular Front, had climbed from 131 to 147 seats. Various small left-wing parties had won 51 seats, an increase of 14 compared with 1932. Most worrying for the right, the Communists had been the biggest winners, a leap from 10 to 72 seats. The victory had been made possible once Stalin, in June 1934, had abandoned with a suddenness like scene-shifting in the theatre, as Bloom put it, the Comintern's denigration of social democrats as social fascists. The growing strength of Hitler's Germany necessitated a complete reversal of earlier communist strategy throughout Europe. The revised strategy entailed working for collective security together with previously decried bourgeois states. At the national level, Stalin now actively encouraged collaboration of communists with socialists and even bourgeois parties in the building of popular fronts of the left to combat the increasing menace of fascism. The move was confirmed at the 7th Congress of the Communist International in the summer of 1935. Within France, pressure for a popular front against fascism had come from below, from grassroots level, at first articulated by trade unions, then adopted by the French Communist Party. The pressure had mounted during the course of 1935. By the autumn, when the radicals joined forces with the socialists and communists, the Popular Front had become a reality. Its election promises included a public works program, marking the end of deflationary economic policy, reduction in the working week, retirement pensions, and the establishment of an unemployment fund. Reflecting the strong anti-fascist mood, paramilitary organizations were to be banned. But radical measures likely to scare the middle classes were avoided. Social revolution would have to wait. The socialists retreated from their advocacy of nationalization of the economy. The communists dropped all talk of Soviets or peasant collectives. The running of the Banque de France was to be broadened to eliminate control by a tight oligarchy of shareholders. But the bank wasn't nationalized. The value of the franc was to be upheld, a reassurance for those in the middle class who had lost savings under the previous left-wing coalition government, though this soon proved an unwise commitment. The right of women to work was guaranteed, but anxious to avoid opening up debate on a possible change to the constitution, advocated by much of the extreme right, there was no mention of their right to have the vote. Bloom, France's first socialist and first Jewish premier, led a government of ministers, including three women from the socialist and radical parties. The communists and a number of minority parties provided support, though they chose to stay out of government. Even before the new government took up office, the biggest wave of strikes France had ever known, often spontaneous and carried out in high spirits, in a carnival-like festive atmosphere, swept across the country. Nearly 2 million workers, many non-unionized, and including large numbers of women on low pay, took part in thousands of strikes, factory occupations and sit-ins, overwhelmingly in the private sector. Restaurants and cafes shut their doors. Hotel guests had to manage without room service. There were no shop assistants to attend to customers in the big Paris department stores. And closed petrol stations meant motorists couldn't refuel their cars. The exhilaration of the strikers and their supporters was one part of the picture. The other was the widespread condemnation of social disorder by middle-class adherents of the right, fearing it was the portal to communism. Political polarization was enhanced. The massive strike wave concentrated the minds of employers. Within a single afternoon on the 7th of June, in a meeting at the Prime Minister's residence at the Hotel Matignon, they conceded to the main demands of the trade unions. Industrial relations were transformed overnight. The right to join a union, collective bargaining, recognition of shop stewards, a ban on punitive action against striking workers, and wage rises of around 15% were all agreed. The 40-hour working week and 2 weeks of paid holiday each year, which, supported by cheap rail fares, began the summer exodus from Paris and other cities that became a permanent feature of French society, was law within days. The strike wave gradually subsided. The blizzard of legislation continued with the ban on paramilitary leagues on the 18th of June, calming political disorder and street violence, though forcing parts of the extreme right underground. Further laws introduced the reform of the Banque de France, raised the school leaving age to 14, nationalized armaments industries, and placated farmers by fixing big increases in grain prices. A new Ministry of Sport and Leisure was established with the aim of democratizing access to outside activities, countering the militarization of leisure in fascist organizations, providing attractive forms of relaxation for the working class and improving public health. As a consequence, cycling, hiking, youth hosteling, and popular tourism were all boosted. Sporting facilities improved, general interest and participation in sport promoted. All in all, the level of intervention undertaken by the Popular Front government in such a short time was remarkable. So was the euphoric mood on the French left. Eric Hobsbawm, later one of Europe's most eminent historians, experienced as a 19-year-old revolutionary the extraordinary atmosphere in Paris on the 14th of July 1936, anniversary of the storming of the Bastille in 1789. He recalled how the red flags and tricolours, the leaders, the contingents of workers, passed before the serried masses on the pavement, the crowded windows, the hospitably waving café proprietors, waiters and clients, the even more hospitable enthusiasm of the assembled and applauding brothel staffs. The summer euphoria swiftly faded. The carnival atmosphere evaporated. The cares and worries of everyday life returned. The government was soon in difficulties. Bloom's limited socialist experiment rapidly ran into powerful headwinds from international market forces. The refusal to devalue the franc revealed itself as a mistake, hampering the government's room for manoeuvre. Big business moved its investment out of the country. The increased cost of the 40-hour week was passed on in price rises, fueling growing inflation that wasn't matched by greater productivity. Pressure on the franc and gold reserves mounted. By September 1936, the government was forced to acknowledge its earlier error and devalue the franc by around a third. Even this didn't remove the pressure on the currency. Workers' earnings and middle-class savings were eaten up by inflation. Support for the government waned. When the Conservative Senate refused to grant the government emergency powers in June 1937 in order to combat the country's financial difficulties, Blum resigned and was replaced by the radical Camille Chauton. Socialist ministers, including Blum, remained in the government, but the socialist impetus was gone. Government was now dominated by the radicals, whose political inclinations were moving them rightwards towards greater conservatism. Chotin, empowered by Parliament to legislate by decree, powers that had been refused to Blum, raised taxes and ended social reforms. Much of what had brought down Blum's government was unchanged. Prices continued to rise, public debt continued to grow, the franc continued to lose value, eventually compelling further devaluation. Productivity continued to stagnate, unrest continued to foment, the Popular Front continued to wither away, racked by intransigent economic problems, facing implacable opposition on the conservative and fascist right, and confronted by increasing danger in international affairs. Blum returned as premier, March 1938, but in a drastically changed international climate, following the incorporation of Austria into the German Reich. By now, France, beset by worries about foreign policy, was impatient of social and economic experimentation. Blum was swiftly disabused of any hope of making progress with new attempts at state-directed investment, exchange controls, and a wealth tax. Rising expenditure on rearmament imposed its own constraints on government spending for civilian purposes, while the flight of capital and plunging gold reserves necessitated further cuts in public expenditure and an eventual third devaluation of the franc. Blum's first administration had lasted 382 days. His second ended after only 26. With his removal for a second time, politics shifted to the conservative right under the leadership of the new prime minister, the radical Édouard Daladier. He was seen as a safe pair of hands, the very epitome of small-town provincial France. Backed by both small and big capital, and lauded by the right for reversing much of Blum's social legislation, thus terminating the Revolution of June 1936. The construction of a popular front, bringing socialists, communists, and the political centre as represented by the radicals together in an attempt to confront and defeat fascism in France, was a rational and sensible strategy. At the very least, it halted the threat to the Republic from the paramilitary right. But if a popular front was necessary, it's equally clear that its failure to establish itself was almost guaranteed from the outset. A revolutionary social program, such as the communists would have favored, stood no chance of being adopted. With the backing of no more than 15% of the population, it would have been impossible to push through. The middle-class clientele of the radicals would have been horrified at any threat to their property, and the socialists were compelled to tread a careful line that didn't squander support either to their left or right. But piecemeal social reforms introduced in the face of opposition from much of the population, wrung out of the representatives of big business and buffeted by international market forces, had the odds stacked heavily against their success. The creation of the Popular Front was only possible through compromise, amounting to a shotgun marriage between ideologically incompatible partners. The compromise temporarily painted over the deep divides in the face of a common enemy. But it was a fragile construction whose foundations were undermined by the daunting problems facing the government. Relations between the two left-wing parties were themselves severely tested. Socialist antipathy towards the communists was heightened by widely publicized negative accounts of conditions in the Soviet Union and by reports of Stalinist show trials. The communists, for their part, regarded Blum as the killer of workers after police had opened fire on communist protesters, killing six and wounding 200, at a demonstration in Clichy, a working-class district of Paris, in March 1937. The Spanish Cauldron. The failure of the left in France was about to recede into the shade of a much greater tragedy for the left in Spain, as the travails of the Popular Front government were overtaken in public consciousness by events unfolding across the Spanish border. The Spanish left, with extensive popular backing and the resources of the state at its disposal, was ready to fight to defend the Republic. It was seriously weakened, nevertheless, by bitter factional divisions, internecine conflicts and ideological rifts, overlain by regional separatist feeling stronger than anywhere else in Western Europe, especially in the economically relatively advanced Catalonia and in the Basque country. Even more damaging for the left was the long-standing deep polarization of Spanish society. In contrast, even to France, a chasm separated the ideological groupings of left and right in Spain. Republican loyalties weren't as deep-rooted as in France, nor were they tied to an epochal, symbolic event in the nation's history equivalent to the French Revolution. The Second Republic in Spain was a very recent foundation, dating back only to April 1931. It had been brought about by the left and was fundamentally rejected by practically all on the increasingly extreme right, whose anti-socialism was profound, visceral, and widespread. The detestation of the left was easily woven into the fabric of untarnished Catholic values that blanketed much of provincial Spain, and which the right had incorporated into their imagery of the Spanish nation. This hostility was backed, of course, by the traditional power elites, who had most to lose from feared socialist rule, the landowners, leading industrialists, the Catholic Church, and, most importantly, significant sections of the army's officer corps. Their power was in retreat, but still unbroken. Removing the Republic by force was for them an option. After all, Primo de Rivera's dictatorship had only ended a few years earlier in January 1930, and the pronunciamiento, or military coup, had long held a place in Spanish politics. By March 1936, Spanish generals were conspiring to launch a new attempt to overthrow an elected government. The triumph of the socialist and republican left in the 1931 elections had, as was noted in Chapter 5, proved short-lived. By November 1933, when new elections took place, the right had regathered strength. The left were heavily defeated by a right-wing coalition of CEDA and the radicals, under their leader Alejandro Lerroux, who became prime minister. The following 2 years then ended, often upturned, the modest social advances made since the foundation of the Republic. For the left, these were the Bienio Negro, the two black years, of growing fascist threat and heavy repression. A two-week strike in the northern region of Asturias in October 1934 by miners armed with whatever they could lay hands on, and taking on the police, had ended when it was bloodily suppressed by notably brutal troops, specially brought in from Morocco by none other than the future dictator, General Francisco Franco. The repression was savage, often barbarous. Some 2,000 civilians were left dead, 4,000 injured, and 30,000 jailed, many of them tortured while in prison. Spain was already verging on civil war. When the right-wing governing coalition fell apart, beset by financial scandals and political wrangling, new elections were called for February 1936. The left had meanwhile formed a popular front, an electoral pact of Republicans, whose backing was largely middle-class, and socialists, the two major forces, supported with varying degrees of enthusiasm by the communists, Catalan separatists, and socialist and anarchist trade unions. Opposing them in the election was a national bloc of right-wing groups. The country was split down the middle, and more radicalized than ever. The election was portrayed as a contest for Spain's future. For the right, it was a choice between good and evil, Catholicism or communism, the Spain of ancient traditions or the anti-Spain of demolition, church burning and revolution. Left-wing voices threatened to do in Spain what has been done in Russia. When the votes were counted, the Popular Front had won a historic victory. Narrow in the numbers of votes cast, 4,654,111 to 4,503,524, yet overwhelming in the distribution of parliamentary seats, 278 to the right's 124. The Popular Front's unity lasted no longer than the election. The government, comprised only of Republicans, was feeble from the outset. The socialists, themselves disunited, refused to participate. The party was split between its reformist wing, headed by the moderate Indalecio Prieto, and the increasingly revolutionary General Workers' Union, led by Francisco Largo Caballero, who reveled in the appellation the Spanish Lenin, bestowed upon him by the Soviet press. The socialist youth movement, like the trade union organization, also saw the future in terms of full-scale revolution, not piecemeal reformism. The attractions of the Communist Party, still small but growing fast, were evident. The government started to restore the social and economic changes of 1931 to 33, released political prisoners, expropriated land from big estates, and gave back autonomy to Catalonia, promising it too to the Basques. But the government's control was weak. Poor peasants and agricultural labourers occupied big estates in southern Spain. Strikes broke out in urban centres. The burning of churches, symbols of the oppressive hand of Catholic power, was more widespread than it had been in 1931, and a propaganda gift to the right. Numerous murders were perpetrated by both the left and right. Both were moving further to the extremes. The Falange, previously a small faction on the right, suddenly found itself winning new recruits, many from members of the youth movement of the Spanish Confederation of the Autonomous Right, CEDA, who backed a more aggressive anti-republican stance than many older supporters of the party. And meanwhile, with the government unawares, the conspiracy was brewing. Some army leaders, including Franco, had contemplated a coup directly after the election. But the time wasn't ripe. Instead, the generals watched and waited. The government had sought to neutralize potential trouble from the military by removing Franco from his position as chief of staff and dispatching him to the Canary Islands. General Emilio Mola, known to be bitterly hostile to the Republic, and in fact the prime mover behind the planned coup, was also demoted. Remarkably, however, Mola was brought back from a command in Spanish Morocco and placed in charge of a garrison in Pamplona, in northern Spain, a prime location from which he could forge close links with clandestine supporters of an uprising. Some Falangists were arrested, though they were still able to organize even from within jail. But a weak government took little other action to preempt trouble. On the 17th of July 1936, the uprising began in Spanish Morocco and the Canaries, spreading to mainland Spain over the next 2 days. The conspirators had expected a swift coup and military takeover, but it was soon apparent that this wasn't going to happen. In some areas, mainland garrisons and much of the population backed the rebels. Three prime ministers within 2 days was a clear sign of government panic. Mola, felt confident enough to turn down a request for a compromise truce. Elsewhere, however, even though they were often hedging their bets, the army and police remained loyal to the Republic. Workers in Madrid, Barcelona, San Sebastian, in the Basque country, and elsewhere took up arms. Within a matter of days, Spain was completely divided, much as it had been in the February election. The East and South remained mostly on the Republican side. The rebels had, however, made rapid gains in the southwest, the west, and much of central Spain. Militarily, the forces of the Republic and the rebels were fairly evenly balanced. Economically, the most important industrial regions were still in government hands. People, down to village level, took sides, left or right, the Republic or fascism. Violence spiraled. Even in the first days, there were serious atrocities on both sides. In the areas they conquered, the rebels killed and summarily executed large numbers. The exact number killed is impossible to establish, though it certainly ran into the thousands. On the Republican side, too, there were widespread acts of revenge against supporters of the uprising or class enemies. Scores were settled. Revolutionary justice in improvised tribunals led to numerous executions. Horrific violence was directed at the clergy. Over 6,000 members of the clergy, priests, monks, and nuns, were murdered. Churches burnt down, religious images destroyed. It was already turning into a full-scale civil war. But no outright winner was in sight. An important shift in the balance of military power began in late July and August, when Hitler and Mussolini, keen to prevent communism gaining a foothold on the Iberian Peninsula, provided the planes to transport Franco's crack army of Africa, more than 30,000 hardened, experienced fighters, from Morocco to mainland Spain. This was the start of increasing aid to Franco's troops from Germany and Italy. Both Hitler and Mussolini hoped eventually to have backing from a nationalist Spain, and in the meantime welcomed the opportunity to try out their firepower well away from home. Salazar's Portugal, fearful of Bolshevism triumphing next door, also supplied men and supplies for the rebels. As a result, the rebel nationalists had a marked advantage. It could have been more than countered had the Western democracies supplied arms to a fellow democracy. However, in August, Britain, closely followed by France, where Blum was mentally torn and conscience-stricken about depriving Spanish socialists of aid, led the way in reaching international agreement not to provide war materials to Republican Spain. They were anxious to prevent the deepening conflict there turning into a full-scale European war. But as a result, the struggle became sharply tilted towards the prospect of nationalist victory. Stalin responded in the autumn to a plea for military aid from the Republican government, but the imbalance in arms supplies continued. Eventually, 24 countries signed the non-intervention agreement. Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union all signed it, cynically paying lip service to non-intervention while providing arms in great quantities. In spite of official policies of non-intervention, at least 30,000 volunteers, a fair number of them Jewish, from various European countries, mostly socialists, communists, and trade unionists organized by the Comintern into international brigades, travelled to Spain from the autumn of 1936 onwards to try to save the Republic. Most of them, in one way or another, were idealists, fighting as they saw it in a class war and in a struggle to defeat fascism. Thousands of them lost their lives in the attempt. Their military contribution was exaggerated by Soviet propaganda at the time, and often has been since. But the brigades certainly played their part in some of the big battles, starting with the fight to save Madrid from the rebel forces. In the judgment of one British journalist, Henry Buckley, who saw the brigades in action, by and large, they were heroes in the way they fought. Their weapons were bad, discipline was hard to obtain, they spoke a dozen different languages and few of them any Spanish. They worked miracles by sheer heroism. For the European left, the beginning of the Spanish Civil War was a source of inspiration. Gradually, it turned into a source of demoralization. Once Franco's troops, pushing northwards towards Madrid, had failed to take the Spanish capital after a lengthy siege in November 1936, the Civil War descended into a lengthy attritional struggle fought with boundless savagery. A pattern developed of slow but relentless advances by the nationalists, while the Republicans, though capable of producing short-lived counter-offensives, were mainly forced into resilient but increasingly desperate defence. The spring and summer of 1937 saw nationalist forces make major advances in the north. By the autumn, after they had secured the northern coast, including the Basque country, giving Franco access to vital raw materials and a crucial industrial region, the Republican government's control was confined to a large block of territory stretching southeast of Madrid to the coast and, in the north, little more than Catalonia. The Civil War presented the Germans with the opportunity to carry out bombing experiments without responsibility on our part, as Wolfram Freiherr von Richthofen, commander of the Condor Legion, the German bomber fleet, put it. The bombing of a number of southern Spanish towns followed raids on Madrid. Richthofen found the results very good. The Italians were by the spring of 1938 also bombing Spanish towns and villages in the nationalist northern offensive, while the Germans stepped up their attacks to support the offensive by dropping 600 tons of bombs on Bilbao. The terrible attack on the Basque town of Guernica by about 30 German and 3 Italian bombers on the afternoon of the 26th of April 1937, which shocked and appalled the world, didn't stand in isolation. That very morning, German bombers had left no house intact in a raid on Guernica-Ís, 8 kilometres away. The sustained attack on Guernica itself lasted 3 hours and aimed at demoralising the Basques. In German eyes, a complete technical success, left the small town a smouldering ruin with around 300 of its citizens dead. A priest who had arrived just in time to witness the devastation vividly described the screams as people fled in terror from the marketplace with the town in flames. Pablo Picasso's famous painting, displayed in the Spanish pavilion of the Paris World Exhibition in 1937, immortalized the destruction of Guernica in a graphic depiction of the barbarism of modern war. Despite worldwide condemnation, heavy German bombing in Spain continued. Towards the end of the fighting in Asturias that autumn, the Condor Legion command took the decision to deploy the squadrons ruthlessly against all places and methods of transport in the reduced red living space. The war was far from over in the autumn of 1937, but it had taken an inexorable course. The nationalist conquest of Spain was slow but relentless. The slowness was partly because of strong Republican defence. It owed much, however, to Franco's conduct of the war. The war was for him a crusade to restore the greatness of Catholic Spain. This demanded the eradication, not just the defeat, of those he saw as Spain's inner enemies. Franco was, consequently, in no hurry to win a quick but superficial victory. Francisco Franco, born in 1892, had spent all his formative years in the army. A combination of first-rate skills as a military commander, burning ambition, and unwavering determination had taken him to the top of the army. Although late to join the conspiracy against the Republic, his command of the Army of Africa was crucial to its success. By the end of September 1936, he was accepted by nationalists as supreme commander of the army and head of state. The following April, he unified the various factions of the right in a single party, whose title was such a mouthful: Falange Española Tradicionalista y de las Juntas, Traditional Spanish Phalanx of the National Syndicalist Offensive Groups. That it was as good as never used in full, and invariably shortened to FET. Franco had none of the populist charisma of Hitler or Mussolini. He was a military product through and through. He hadn't arrived at his preeminent position through rabble-rousing speeches and political manoeuvring, but through the army ranks and through his undoubted military talent. In personal appearance, he was unprepossessing, small, with a shrill, high-pitched voice. He was, however, ice-cold in his ruthlessness towards his enemies, who, in his eyes, were many. He saw Freemasonry, communism, and separatism as the evils that had brought decadence, corruption, and decline to Spain since its golden age in the 16th century. His caution as a military commander was inseparable from his determination to consolidate the nationalist conquests of Spain through the complete and lasting elimination of the enemy that stood in his way. He personally read through the death sentences following mass trials of his opponents and signed them. His forces carried out in all around 200,000 executions. 1 million prisoners were stuffed into his jails and labor camps. It was intended to serve as a lesson forevermore to the left and his other enemies. That the Republic was able to resist Franco's forces with such resilience and for so long is in itself remarkable, given the divisions, infighting, rancor, and ideological incompatibility that beset the government side. Socialists, themselves bitterly split, anarchists, socialist and anarchist trade unions, communists following Stalin's line, factions of communism that rejected Stalin's line, and the Catalan left with its own agenda, all were united by little more than their overriding determination to defeat fascism. Purist definitional differences over whether the national forces were genuinely fascist are immaterial. For Republicans, they were fascists. Who is to say that they were wrong in this? Anti-fascism was the most powerful of unifying forces. Beyond it lay only splits and factions. The Republic had seemed close to disintegration in the early months of the war. The government itself left beleaguered Madrid in November 1936 and moved to Valencia, retreating the following October still further to Barcelona in Catalonia. By then, state authority had often been replaced by anti-fascist committees that had sprung up following the nationalist rising and had expropriated powers in their localities. Basque nationalists declared an autonomous Basque Republic. Catalonia, too, went its own way, as did Aragon. The anarchist and socialist trade unions pushed through what amounted to a spontaneous social revolution. Landed property, industries, and businesses were turned into collectives. Local militias set up. Government was taken over by local revolutionary councils. Much of it was fairly chaotic, though it functioned after a fashion, at least in the short term. George Orwell described the conditions in Barcelona, where he had joined the militia of a small, non-Moscow-aligned communist organization, the Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxista, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, usually abbreviated to POUM. practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers and was draped with red flags, or with the red and black flag of the anarchists. Every wall was scrawled with a hammer and sickle and with the initials of the revolutionary parties. Almost every church had been gutted and its images burnt. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying that it had been collectivized. Practically everyone wore rough working-class clothes or blue overalls or some variant of the militia uniform. The social revolution was unlikely to endear itself to many beyond committed Marxists, though there was little choice but to comply with the new order. The militia themselves were inadequately armed and badly organized, a complete rabble by any ordinary standard, as Orwell saw it. It was improbable that such forces would win a war against Franco's well-armed, disciplined troops. Central government had to adapt, and swiftly. Socialists and communists entered a genuinely popular front government in September, headed by Largo Caballero, now seen temporarily as a unifying, not divisive figure. The government was in agreement that social revolution had to wait for another day. In the meantime, there was an urgency in replacing militias with a properly organized army. Gradually, central authority was asserted. A unified army, backed by a centralized economy, conscription, rationing, and organized civil defense, took shape. Some of this was under increased Soviet influence. With the arrival of Stalinist arms, the influence of the communists in the government grew. And the communists were not at heart interested in a bourgeois republic, but only in saving it from fascism in order to direct a genuine revolution at a later date, and meanwhile in eliminating all rivals such as Trotskyists and anarchists on the radical left. In May 1937, Largo Caballero was forced out of office and replaced by Juan Negrín, a shrewd politician and competent administrator, he had previously been finance minister, who regarded a more dominant communist role as the acceptable price and best chance of defeating Franco. In Catalonia and Aragon, the social revolution was brought to an end and the POUM crushed in a ruthless purge. The Republic was able to fight on, though the increased influence of the communists was far from welcomed by many in the Republican zone and contributed to declining morale. By 1938, the final agony of the Republic was approaching. A last big Republican offensive failed on the lower Ebro River in eastern Spain. Morale was deteriorating fast, war weariness widespread, food supplies were running low. Catalonia finally fell in early 1939. Huge numbers of prisoners were captured and left to the tender mercies of the nationalists. 500,000 refugees fled into France and an uncertain, often miserable future. What was left of Republican control crumbled in March. On the 26th of March, the nationalists at last entered Madrid. By the end of the month, the remainder of Republican territory was in their hands. On the 1st of April, Franco declared the war over. Over 200,000 men had died on the battlefield, well over 1 million from a population of 25 million suffered death, torture, or imprisonment. Many more fled into exile. Franco and his followers showed no mercy after victory. Typifying the spirit of a redemptive purge to purify Spain was the man appointed as president of the National Tribunal of Political Responsibilities, Enrique Suñer Ordóñez. A former professor of pediatric medicine in Madrid, he had described Republicans in 1938 as devilish, sadists and madmen, monsters. Behind them he saw Freemasons, socialists, anarchists, and Soviet-backed Jews whose plans in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were being realized. In his warped mind, the purpose of the war was to strengthen the race and to bring about the total extirpation of our enemies. Such attitudes characterized the vindictive approach to a demonized left. Some 20,000 Republicans were executed after the war had been won. Thousands more died in prisons, camps, and in forced labor battalions. The killing went on well into the 1940s. Silence now descended over the half of Spain that had defended the Republic against Franco's nationalist rebels. Discrimination, hardship, and suffering, together with bitter accommodation to the new repressive dictatorship, were all that was left of them. The silence would last for over 35 years until Franco's death in 1975 brought a new start for Spain. Could the Civil War have been avoided? It seems unlikely. The chances of avoiding it were low by 1936. The country was completely divided, and the government in the first months after the election in February was fast losing control. When in May, Prieto was asked to form an administration but was blocked by his left-wing rival, Largo Caballero, the last chance of avoiding a civil war had probably gone. A strong but moderate socialist government at this point might have headed off at least some of the middle classes who were frightened of the extreme left and shifting rightwards to support the nationalists. As it was, Largo Caballero ensured that the government remained weak and the left divided, while most of the middle classes looked to the rebels rather than the Republic. Nor could Prieto's plans to limit the powers of the police, disarm fascist terror squads, and appoint a trusted head of state security be put into practice. It's extremely doubtful whether Prieto could have introduced reforms that would have diffused the situation, given how little faith much of the left now had in a moderate solution, and how determined the right was to overthrow the Republic. It's equally doubtful whether he or any other Republican leader could have wielded sufficient power to arrest right-wing leaders or remove significant military leaders whose loyalty to the Republic was known to be dubious. The attempt was, in any case, not made. Those wishing the Republic greatest harm were allowed their freedom to plot the military uprising intended to bring it down. Could the Civil War have been won by the Republic? Once the uprising had taken place, Mola had refused truce terms. Franco had transported the Army of Africa from Morocco to Spain, and the Nationalists had consolidated early substantial territorial gains. A victory for the Republic became increasingly unlikely, and by mid-1937 was as good as impossible. The divisions and conflicts on the left didn't help the Republic. However, they didn't cause the defeat. Government forces were, if never altogether efficiently, gradually able to fight a lengthy defensive war. At no point, though, did they look capable of ultimate victory. They might have done so, had not the lopsided nature of foreign intervention in a conflict that rapidly acquired the character of a surrogate ideological contest between the international forces of fascism and communism, given a distinct advantage to the nationalists. As it was, while Soviet aid enabled Republican forces to prolong the fight but little more, arms to the rebel nationalist forces from fascist Italy and Nazi Germany were vital in helping ensure military success. Crucially, the non-intervention policy of the Western democracies and the USA's determination to observe strict neutrality meant that apart from Soviet aid, the Republicans were feeding off scraps while the Nationalists were in receipt of regular flows of arms from the fascist powers. Such an imbalance practically ruled out a Republican victory and made Franco's eventual triumph practically certain. The war left Spain mourning its dead, though with many of its most bitter wounds concealed for generations. Its society still utterly riven, even if the deep divides were now concealed beneath a thin veneer of a declared national unity. Its economy in ruins, its prospects of much-needed modernization delayed for years to come.